There is an immense marble statue that stands at the end of a long colonnade in Florence, Italy. It is, in my opinion, the most meaningful statue that has ever been chiseled out of marble. It stands at the cul-de-sac, if you will, that sun-drenched section of this artistic place full of sculptured works from the Renaissance genius Michelangelo. As you walk your way toward this statue that stands 18 feet high, you see on both right and left limbs and torso and parts of the human anatomy that this incredible and gifted man has brought to life out of cold stone. The place is called the Galleria dell'Accademia. The name isn't important, but the works there are priceless. I think the statue that stands at the end of the colonnade is more impressive than the mammoth work of Moses that is on the streets of Rome there at the fountain. And even more meaningful than the winged victory that was once at Samothrace and has now been moved appropriately to the Louvre in Paris. When you are there in your travels, take your time to stand and study this impressive work of art. It towers over all the viewers, and if the crowd is not too large, you will have time and room to walk around it and to study both front and back. You will look into eyes that are at once both fierce and compassionate as this master with the chisel and mallet has brought from the eyes almost a living stare. You'll find yourself wanting to reach out and touch those fluid lines that are so like Michelangelo. But what will be so meaningful to you will not be the oversized hands that hold a leather sling, or even that muscular abdomen and those strong legs, but it will be the memory of what you have learned about this youngest son of Jesse. Those same fingers were able to pluck the ancient harp and soften the soil of the soul of Saul, demonized by depression. It will almost be as if he would look down at you and smile with understanding. I love the statue. I spent about an hour simply staring at it. Cynthia was with me and she went on to other works of art in this place, but I stood there. It was a long-awaited dream for me. I had seen pictures of it as you have, but I had never seen this 18-foot high statue of David. Dave Roper, in a new work entitled The Song of a Passionate Heart, writes, Michelangelo was right to sculpt David with such immensity. He was a giant of a man. Combining in himself the military genius of Alexander the Great, the political savvy of Abraham Lincoln, the musical talent of Beethoven, the literary skill of Shakespeare, the hand-eye coordination of Joe Montana. But the real measure of David's magnitude was his obsession with God. One thing I ask of the Lord, he wrote, This is what I seek, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, to gaze upon the beauty of the Lord and to seek Him in His temple. Roper concludes, he was a man who was preoccupied with the love of God. I suppose that's why I stayed there so long. It isn't often you're in a presence of a person like that. I sort of drank it all in. It took Michelangelo 4 years almost to sculpt that work of art. Not only because it is immense in size, but because the block of marble was flawed when removed from the quarry. And I think symbolically illustrating that David himself, as great as he was also a man flawed. Flawed at birth. Flawed from birth. Living with that old nature that you and I fight with every day of our lives. Flawed as a little boy in a family of 10 children, 8 boys, 2 girls. And he was the youngest, at least the youngest of all the boys. I think, quite honestly, that David was a man who was love-starved. I think he was probably not planned, not expected, and perhaps not even wanted. As we shall see, David was such a forgotten part of the family that when one came to anoint the next king of Israel, the father didn't even bring him in from among the sheep. If he was wanted, he certainly was not desired deep within the heart of that father. I think, frankly, he was virtually forgotten in the family. I also think that he was ignored and disrespected by his own brothers. He grew up lonely. God graciously shaped the man to become the only one of whom it is said in all the scripture, the man after his own heart. All these things, and there is so much more I could say introducing this 4-part series, but all of these things have led me to choose 4 scenes from the life of this great man of God for our time together during these chapel hours. His biography eclipses all others save Christ himself in the scriptures. Abraham occupies 14 chapters. Joseph the same, 14 chapters. Elijah, that prophet, not even 10 chapters. But David, would you believe 62 chapters? Some would name 4 more from the Chronicles. No other person in all the New Testament is referenced more often out of the Old than David, almost 60 times. He is a man of consuming presence in the mind of the biblical writers, and I think should be the same in ours as well. Due to the brevity of our time, we'll limit these brief studies to 4 scenes, and I'll give them to you now, and then we will look at the first until my time is up today. Scene 1, David, chosen and called by God. Scene 2, David, challenged by the giant. That will be tomorrow. Scene 3, David, tested from within. And scene 4, as you probably would expect, David, tempted from without. My hope, of course, is that these studies will prove very helpful for you in your own ministry. I hope that though you will forget much of what I say, I hope you will not forget everything, because there is something in each of these 4 vignettes that you will return to again and again in your ministry. I know, for I have already done that. And I still do that. I hope you see your calling and you're being chosen by God as you see it in David's life. I hope you will envision the giants that are upon you and will soon be as you see David fighting that one. I hope you will realize the tests did not stop with David, but they will inevitably come to you from within, just as he experienced, and also the temptations will come from without. In each of these four vignettes, there are characters that play a major part alongside David. In the first is Samuel the prophet. In the second scene is Goliath of Gath, the Philistine. In the third scene, of course, is Saul, the current king of Israel. And in the fourth scene is Bathsheba and her husband Uriah. Now, I'd like you to turn not first to Samuel, which records those details I've been going over, but first to Psalm number 78. The psalm is a maskil of Asaph, according to the superscription. It's an instructive psalm. It's a psalm that takes you through some of the brighter lights of Israel's history, and some of the lowlights as well. It brings us all the way to the reign of David, verse 70, down to the end of the chapter. The He is God, of course, and the statement is made that God, He, chose David, His servant. That God took him from sheepfolds, from the care of the ewes with suckling lambs. Isn't that a tender way to put it? From the care of the ewes with suckling lambs, God brought David to shepherd Jacob his people and Israel his inheritance. And so he did. David shepherded them according to the integrity of his heart, and David guided them with his skillful hands. And when I read hands, I think again of that statue. Those hands. There was something in the heart of David, God observed, that had not been in the heart of Saul. And God, by now, by the choosing of David, was weary of Saul. Tired of the rash and inappropriate acts of his life. He knew ahead of time, he knew in all of time that Saul was not the man, but graciously allowed the people in their moment of envy about other nations who had their kings to choose Saul as their first king. But by now, everyone was weary of Saul, it seemed, except the loyal army that worked and fought alongside him. And so God began the scanning process as his eyes looked to and fro over all the earth to find one whose heart was completely his. And he landed upon one who was keeping his father's sheep. There was a spiritual sensitivity about David then, and it remained in him throughout his life, his flaws and failures notwithstanding. Oh, there were periods where he showed dullness and carnality, but David really had a heart that beat after God. I think what it means when it says that he had a heart for God, it means that what was important to God was important to David. And somehow in the process of time, as he grew up, somewhat alone and with the sheep in the wilderness, and perhaps even at the schools of the prophets that had been sponsored by and provided by Samuel, somehow in the process of his growing up years, David caught this love for God. And according to the record, God chose him because there was in his heart this sense of integrity, this servant-hearted craving for spiritual things. There was this humility, this willingness to work with sheep. There was this model of integrity. Tamam, it means to be solid, to be unimpaired, to be whole. We would even use the word wholesome within. I want to give you a principle regarding God's choices that will encourage most of you and surprise some. God's choice of a person is usually contrary to human reasoning. I mean, if you and I lived on the farm next to Jesse with his sons and daughters, we may not have even known David existed. He was a nobody. He was there to do the chores. He was there to take care of the responsibilities that the brothers didn't want to do. He was there to sort of be pushed around and to carry out those jobs behind the scenes. What a strange choice that God would choose a person trained like that. God's reasoning for selecting individuals, totally different from ours. If you will hold your place right there and go to 1 Corinthians chapter 1, you'll see what I'm getting at. Paul speaks of God's calling to Greeks who were in Corinth, or at least to Jews who were impressed with Grecian lifestyle, who loved a good show, who were impressed with intellectualism and oratory and rhetoric and all of those great public things that are done for the purpose of impressing. And the apostle says to those in Corinth, 1 Corinthians 1:26, consider your calling, brethren. There were not many wise according to the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble. Linger there for a moment, wise, not many intellectually impressive according to human standards. Not many mighty, that is, politically suave and influential. Not many noble, aristocratic, socially superior. There were not many of those chosen among you. Look at your ranks. Look around, Corinthians. But rather, God has chosen the foolish things of the world to shame the wise. God has chosen weak things to shame the things which are strong, and base things of the world, and even the despised. God has chosen things that are not, that are hardly worth noticing, that he might nullify the things that are. Why? Verse 29 answers the question that no person should boast before God. Look at your own self. There are not many noble among us. There are not many suave, not many of political stature. I mean, compared to the world's eyes, not many that brilliant. That's as God planned it. When you choose those who qualify with all of these impressive records, it surprises no one that great things are achieved on this earth. But when you choose those who have kept their father's sheep and have been pushed around by their siblings and have been considered of little importance to the family, even to the parents, it's a shocking thing to realize that God would raise one of them to become a king and another to minister in a world like ours. Such are some of us. I may have mentioned it to all of you before. I can't recall. I'm speaking so much these days, I forget where I've said this or that. I am the youngest in a family of three. I have a very, very brilliant and capable brother who was a missionary in Argentina for 32 years. And I remember awakening in the middle of the night and seeing my brother on his knees beside his bed. We shared twin beds in a little cracker box house in East Houston where I was raised. And I remember the moonlight shining in the window. I remember it like it was yesterday. And I was a young teenager. My brother was an older teenager. And I remember thinking, good night. Why couldn't I have a normal brother? I got Martin Luther to share this this bedroom with. He loved Christ before I was ever interested in him and has distinguished himself as a magnificent missionary statesman. concert pianist. My sister, extremely talented, and some of you have heard her as she has spoken here in Yon, worked 29 years with Mobil Oil Company, not only here in Texas, but out in Southern California. Very gifted, capable person, and one whom I love dearly. My brother, 3 years older than I, my sister, 2 years older than I, and then I came along. I wasn't planned. I didn't understand that until our third child was conceived, and then I understood what that meant fully. But when my mother would say to me, "You were a mistake," well, where do you go from there, huh? She didn't mean that to be cruel. She was just helping me understand that I wasn't planned. And my brother would bring home the most boring report cards you could imagine from school. Mine had variety and choice you could enjoy. Who would ever have expected that that God would choose me? I'm not in this category of a David. I just use myself because I don't know of a better example of grace than this one. I come from no pedigree. I have nothing in my background that would impress anyone in this place. If you knew me better, you would realize that even more. Which always causes me to come to someone like a David and pause and feel a sense of affinity. And with some of you who have come from the more rugged side of life, welcome. You belong here. We are the kind God chooses and uses by His grace. We see these finished products and somehow we think, to have that kind of individual's background. And if you pause to study far and long enough, you'll find that background is no more impressive than your own. Take heart, brothers and sisters. We have all been taken from the sheepfolds, from caring for those ewes with suckling lambs, and doing that which is altogether unimpressive. But that's the whole point of the principle. God's choice is contrary to human reasoning. We look for intelligence, we look for image, we look for personality, and we look for that which impresses. We look for great leadership skills, and we forget that we all began from the same flawed quarry. And may we never let that get too far from our conscious awareness. You see, Eli had died and had left in his legacy two rebellious sons. Samuel was old, had run out of soup. He was tired. Oh, he walked with God, but his sons, who could have followed in his train, were not qualified. They too were disqualified from being in leadership. And so the nation was on hold. And they looked around and they saw the other nations and they grabbed at that hope of being like them. Give us a king like other nations. And God graciously, to use today's terms and our human terms, reluctantly shrugged his shoulders and said, "You're going to be sorry." And so they were. Enter Saul, who made a royal mess of things almost before you could blink. Back to 1 Samuel chapter 13. I just quickly set the stage. Samuel said to Saul, verse 13, "You have acted foolishly. You have not kept the commandment of the Lord your God, which he commanded you, for now the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever. But now your kingdom shall not endure. The Lord has sought out for himself," here's the phrase, found here and nowhere else, "a man after his own heart, and the Lord has appointed him as ruler over his people." Isn't that interesting? They haven't even put their finger on David, but the Lord's already got him in mind. It's a great moment for me to pause and say, you sit in this seat here at Dallas Seminary and you wonder if there is a God who is even aware of you and where you're going today. Take heart from verse 14. He has his finger on you. He knows exactly where he will use you. He knows exactly how he will use you. And to what extent and in what places. How encouraging. Believe me, it's even more encouraging not knowing it all ahead of time. There is a sense of relief in knowing the future stretches out in an uncharted course, and you're simply required to walk it one day at a time. So stay by the sheep. Do the work of a servant. Remember, his hand is upon you. He knows exactly what he's doing. You are not out of his attention. Isaiah writes in one place, can a woman forget her sucking child that she may not have compassion on the son of her womb? Yeah, they may forget, but I will not forget thee. I have inscribed you upon the palms of my hands. Your ways are continually before me. Isaiah 49:15-16. Your ways are continually before me. Your days at Dallas Seminary are continually before him. Every course, every class, every test, every grade, every experience, every loss, every tear. Your ways are continually before him. How strange it is that we live and operate around a school that has such pristine theology, and yet in experience we can operate as though we are atheists. Our God knows exactly what he is about and precisely what it takes to put you through to prepare that heart after his own heart. And so you are where you are, going through what you were going through. A couple of chapters later in 1 Samuel 15:26, Samuel finally says to Saul, I will not return with you, for you have rejected the word of the Lord, and the Lord has rejected you from being king over Israel. Samuel turned to go, and Saul seized the edge of his robe, and it tore. Don't leave! Don't leave! Can't you feel the anxiety? And Saul, he sees it all falling beside him, crumbling in front of his own eyes, and he wanted it so much by now. Something had eroded in Saul's life. There was a time when he was little, but now he was great in his own eyes. And when he heard the death knell, he couldn't stand the sound. Samuel stays by his point, and by chapter 16, he's engaged in finding the new king. A few thoughts here, and then I'm through. The Lord said to Samuel, how long will you grieve over Saul? Since I have rejected him from being king over Israel, fill your horn with oil and go. I will send you to Jesse the Bethlehemite, for I have selected a king for myself among his sons. I've marked in my Bible, I have rejected, I have selected. Isn't that like Psalm 75? He puts up one and puts down another. He promotes one and demotes another. He calls one and brings him on the scene just as another fades and dies. When a man of God dies, nothing of God dies. When a man or woman of God moves on, nothing of God moves on. His hand is still on that work. His heart is still on this nation. And he has selected a king, and he says to Samuel, go among the sons of Jesse. I'll show you the man. Samuel says, how can I go when Saul hears of it? He will kill me. How'd you like to have that reputation? I mean, Saul is so insecure when he hears that someone else is being selected and he's ready to kill him. Of course, he lives that out once David comes to the place of prominence. May God give us a security in our role and in our responsibility. May God take from us every ounce of competition. within the ranks of Christianity. May he allow us to applaud the promotion of one even over ourselves. What character greatness there is in that. Samuel knew Saul too well. The Lord promises him his protection, so Samuel comes to the home of Jesse. Verse 4, he does what the Lord said, and he came to Bethlehem, and the elders of the city came trembling to meet him and said, "Do you come in peace?" They've already picked up this rashness of the current king. They don't know what to expect. He said, "In peace." "Why, I have come to sacrifice to the Lord. Consecrate yourselves and come with me to the sacrifice." He consecrated Jesse and his sons and invited them to the sacrifice. Came about when they entered, then he looked at Eliab. Exhibit A. There's the first son, the oldest of eight. He looks impressive. Tall, dark, handsome. You'd have thought that Samuel would have had his belly full of tall, dark, and handsome by now, since that's what Saul was, but he didn't. And Samuel's quick response as he looks at the exterior, surely the Lord's anointed is standing before him. Eliab was feeling great about that moment. Jesse thought, how good, my firstborn selected to be the next king. And the Lord said to Samuel, wait. Is this a grand verse? If you've never marked it, mark it now. Do not look at his appearance. Do not look at the height of his stature. Those are the things that impress us. He's good looking. He's tall. Well, I have rejected him. And then the principle, God does not see as man sees. For we look at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. Don't you wish you could, just for one 24-hour period? We might all change friends. We would suddenly have a little more realistic view of who is whom and what is what. The Lord continually looks at the heart. We continually look at the externals, and we are so impressed with what we see, or discouraged by what we see. The Lord says, I'm looking at the heart. Remember, I'm after one whose heart is mine. So Eliab didn't qualify. You're gonna meet Eliab tomorrow, and you're gonna like him even less. He is a petty, jealous, small-minded older brother. Now, there's nothing in that for my brother. I love my brother. I just am saying that because it's true of Eliab. Jesse called Abinadab, Exhibit B, and made him pass before Samuel. And now Samuel's got the message. Now the Lord's not in this one. And Jesse made Shammah pass by. That's a third son. Can't you see them all waiting in the wings? You know, washing up, getting all clean for this moment. This is my interview, candidating opportunity. Want to be sure that he sees the best side. But neither has the Lord chosen Shammah. Verse 10, I love this. Jesse made seven of his sons pass before Samuel. Samuel said to Jesse, the Lord has not chosen these. Samuel said to Jesse, are these all the children? Yeah. By golly, I got one more. That's the whole point. That's the whole syndrome of David's early life. We pass over that scene quickly. But it was part of the pain of all of that that made him the man he was. You understand that if you have known rejection and neglect. You understand that best if you have been pushed around and shoved aside. He's a nobody, not even to his daddy. I find it incredible that the man could parade seven sons and not include the eighth. Oh, there remains the youngest, but he's keeping the sheep. Yeah. He doesn't look that great. Smells worse. He's been out there in the field. Why, Samuel doesn't even hesitate. Send and bring him in here, for we will not sit down until he comes. Oh, heart and his chest is beating. It's now in his throat. I'm about to look into the face of the next king. It's got to be him. Now, David is out with the sheep. It's just like any other day. No great sign came in the clouds that morning. No great audible voice in the night. No vision. Nothing. It was just another day, just as in your life. It will be just another day, and the letter will come. Just another day, and suddenly a decision will be made at a place you've never heard of. And it will be your moment. And if you're like David, and I think you probably will be, you'll hardly be able to believe it. David walks in, knows nothing of the entourage, doesn't understand why all the family's staring at him. He walks up. Remember, he's never read 1 Samuel 16. He just walks in. Brought him in. This is the only description of him. He was ruddy. Probably the word means red, light complexion, maybe red-haired. He had beautiful, clear eyes, and he had a handsome appearance. And the Lord says, arise, anoint him. That's the man. Josephus makes comment that at that moment, it was whispered in David's ear what this was all about. I mean, the next thing you knew, he has oil running down his neck. I mean, what is this? And Samuel does the blessing and goes through the brief, almost said inauguration. He goes through the process and says, this is the one. Samuel took the horn of oil, anointed him in the midst of his brothers. Isn't that significant? And the Spirit of the Lord came mightily upon David from that day forward. Samuel arose and went to Ramah. It's all over. Brothers walk out. Dad walks away shaking his head. David stands there, oily. And what does he do? Next time you find David, verse 19, send me your son David who is with the flock. Is that great or what? You and I'd be at Foley's trying on crowns. Changing our business card, King elect. Dr. David, son of Jesse. Not David. You see, he loves his work with his sheep. That's why he was so qualified to work with the nation. When will we learn it? He learned to king it with the sheep. He learned what it was like to get his hands dirty. That's where he learned to be heroic. While nobody was looking. I have so much more I'd love to say. I want to give you three closing comments regarding this choice. I think they apply to us and will apply to every generation that follows. God's promotions are usually sudden and surprising. God's promotions are usually sudden and surprising. Be ready. Your day is coming. It's coming. You don't think so? I didn't think so. Every faculty member at this staff didn't think so. Every past president didn't think so. I've never met a pastor worth his salt who thought so. Surprising and sudden, the oil will flow over your head. Second, God's solutions are often strange and simple. Be open. His solutions are often strange and simple. How strange that it would be David. How simple that he would choose a shepherd. God's selections are always sovereign and sure. It was solitude, it was obscurity, it was monotony, it was reality, all those things wrapped together that prepared David for the man he became. Was that too quick? Solitude, obscurity, monotony, reality. I close with a comment from J. Oswald Sanders. Instead of the prospect inflating David with a sense of his own importance, the simplicity and ingenuousness of his nature was seen in his faithful devotion to present duty. Hear this. That the anointing imparted a new purpose and sense of call is undoubted, but then, as in later life, David displayed amazing self-discipline and patience in awaiting the maturing of heaven's plan. Do you know how long he waited until the rewards came? It's debatable, but I'm guessing about 12 years. I think he was about 18 at this time, and he took the throne when he was 30. 12 years. 12 years after anointed with oil. And then he became the king.